to the Second Court of Appeals. My name is Justice Ann Gardner, and to my right is Justice Robert McCoy, and to my left is Senior Justice, my mind just went blank,
Dixon Holman.
So y'all only sat together for how many years?
We're your panel for this morning. We are calling the second case first, and I assume these are the lawyers for it. And are you ready? All right. Very good. Megan, would you call the case, please, and announce the lawyers?
May it please the court, Mr. Davis McCown to argue for appellant, and Mr. J.T. Milk to argue for the appellee.
Mr. McCown?
May it please the court, attorney for the appellee. My name is Davis McCown. I'm the attorney for the appellate, Philip Thompson. This is an appeal of an order granting summary judgment out of the 96th District Court in Tarrant County, and the order was in favor of the appellee, which is the plaintiff below. And in a nutshell, this appeal involves the interpretation of a mediation agreement which was entered into between the parties in a previous lawsuit. There's not a lot of relevant facts. The bottom line is, in the previous lawsuit involved the appellant selling a house to the appellee, and the appellant, Mr. Thompson, had some problems with the foundation in 2000. He had hired a company to repair the foundations. He had some ongoing problems with the company, and these were all resolved by 2003. He sold the house in 2005, so the foundation repairs had been in effect for 2 years, and he did not have any problems with them. And his summary judgment evidence was, at the time he sold the house, he believed the foundation was just fine. The appellee, however, when she bought the house, believed that there were still ongoing foundation problems. She could not resolve these with him, and so she sued him in the original court, or in the original lawsuit. This led to a mediation, and the mediation led to a mediation agreement, which had two basically relevant clauses to today's dispute. The first is that the defendant and the plaintiff in the original case agreed to split 50-50 certain repairs to the house, some painting, some plaster that was cracked, some other items around the house that needed to be repaired. They agreed to split that 50-50. And that provision really isn't in dispute. The dispute arises from what I refer to as the bidding clause in the brief. And essentially what the bidding clause stated was that the appellant, the defendant below, would secure at least three foundation bids from reputable licensed contractors for these foundation repairs. Then the second part said that once he secured these three bids, he shall select one of the contractors of his choice to complete the required foundation repairs in accordance with generally accepted foundation construction principles. So he did, in fact, go out and obtain three bids, and there's not any dispute that the three bids are competent under the agreement. In other words, nobody's claiming that they weren't reputable or licensed contractors, they didn't know what they were doing or anything like that. The one of the bids, however, came back at what we call the zero bid. They essentially said, we've examined the work performed here, and a company called Due West had originally done the work, and we see that the work done by Due West is properly in place, that the overall maintenance procedures are continuing, that improper maintenance was what was causing the problems, but that no foundation work was needed. But basically, the lawn needed to be watered, and some of the other things you need to do to your foundation to keep it from shifting needed to be performed, but that no work was necessary on the foundation. And that was their conclusion, and they entered a zero bid. The defendant also obtained a bid from a second company for $3,000 and a third company for $8,330. So needless to say, the defendant selected the zero bid. And he sent a check to the plaintiff for the repairs that he was supposed to perform as far as the plaster on the house and the painting and things of that nature, with the notice that one of the bids had come in at zero, and therefore he was relieved under the contract of providing any further work on the foundation. The issue now, then, is, was the defendant allowed to select a zero bid under this agreement, or did the agreement require that he select some bid which required some amount of work? Which leads to the interpretation of the agreement. Specifically, what does the phrase "the required foundation repairs" mean under the agreement? When the defendant refused to pay for anything above the zero bid, the plaintiff again filed suit, which is the suit that led to this appeal. After a hearing, the court entered a summary judgment for $14,130. This broke down to $8,330, which is actually the amount of the highest bid, $2,800 in punitive damages, and $3,000 in attorney's fees. And basically, the defendant's appealing all of that and looking at the breach of contract issues first, which are 1, 3, and 6 in the brief. The bottom line is that the appellant is of the opinion that there was no breach of the contract whatsoever. He complied with the contract as a matter of law because he obtained the three bids, and he was allowed to have a zero bid, and he was allowed to select it.
Mr. McCowan, I have a question. You're calling the zero bid a bid.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
And it's labeled in appendix number 4 as bid, but I don't see where it says it's a bid. And it seems more like an evaluation that determines that there was no damage, which arguably, or at least that's what the appellee says, is not a bid. Since he didn't think any work needed to be done, he's not bidding on any amount for repairs. And I think that's a serious question. Could you respond to that, please?
I believe it's just a question of interpretation as to what's going to constitute a bid, Your Honor. I mean, he went out and evaluated it, as you said, and hit, you know, that's why I'm calling it a zero bid. He essentially said, there's no work necessary here, so I won't take any money from you. I won't charge you anything because there's nothing to be done. I don't think there's anything in the contract that defines bid in such a manner that would add any light to that whatsoever.
Okay.
All right. Now, is this paragraph 3 on, I guess, bait stamp number 209, Defendant Philip Thompson shall select a contractor to do the repairs. Is that what we're talking about here?
No, Your Honor, I believe that's going to be...
I can't read the handwriting. It's the problem.
I believe that's the second section where he agreed to repair some cracks in the plaster, some painting, and some things of that nature.
Same page.
Is it up here somewhere in this other... Yeah. Right? Philip Johnson shall, can you read it for me?
I can, Your Honor, but to be honest, that particular one is the initial mediation agreement, which they conform to a written agreement, which was executed later.
Maybe I've been reading the wrong one all the time.
It's appendix page number 8 in the appellant's brief.
Okay. Well, go ahead with your argument.
Page number 8.
Look at that.
Paragraphs 1, 2, and 3, or numbered paragraphs 1, 2, and 3.
Oh, okay. I've been reading the handwritten one.
I believe that's why they had it typed up to clarify what kind of a mess they had at the mediation.
It says in paragraph 1 that he's going to get three bids for the foundation repairs. Okay, that question's off the table. There's not a question anymore about whether there needs to be repairs. They've decided they need to be repairs. So this bid, in my mind, is not a bid because it doesn't bid for foundation repairs, which has already been determined exist. It says he will obtain three foundation bids, blah, 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 for the foundation repairs to the property. So the fact that repairs need to be made is not a question anymore. That's off the table. It's like liability and damages. Liability has been established. Now we're going to worry about damages. Foundation repairs needing to be made have been established. Now we're going to find out how much they are. So in my mind, this isn't a bid because it doesn't offer a number for the foundation repairs. It's going back to liability. And liability, that bridge has already been crossed.
Well, the problem then is there's nothing in the agreement that ever specifies what these repairs are to be. If you don't define the repairs in terms of what the foundation companies say is necessary, there's no definition anywhere so that the plaintiff and the defendant can say, yeah, this is what you were supposed to do or this isn't what you're supposed to do. In the next paragraph, the next sentence down, he says that the defendant should complete the required foundation repairs in accordance with generally accepted foundation and construction principles. I guess what I'm saying is if you read the contract as a whole and look at everything, the only logical conclusion is that what they're calling required foundation repairs there is what the foundation company say are required.
Well, if there was a question about whether repairs needed to be made, then that's what this would have called for. We're going to get three inspectors to go out there and determine whether repairs need to be made or not, and if they do, we'll proceed. But that's not what this says.
Well,
they've already decided repairs need to be made.
That would have clarified it, but that, like I say, then you still have to question what are those repairs. They're not defined anywhere. And if you look at the paragraph number 3, it kind of adds to it, because this is the paragraph where he says he's going to repair the plaster and the painting and everything. And he says, in the third sentence there, it says, which are the direct result of the foundation damage and or defects to the paint, plaster, caulking since the property was sold. So he's specifically saying here, either foundation damage has caused this, or it was, you know, sort of shoddy workmanship and shoddy materials that caused this. We're not admitting which one it was. And if he was admitting that the foundation damages existed in paragraph 1, then you wouldn't need that or in paragraph 3 to say it's either damages or it's bad workmanship.
Unless some were caused by foundation damages, which undoubtedly would be the cracks emanating from the corners of the windows and doors, and there's some other things somewhere else that may have very well been caused by shoddy workmanship. So I don't think you can just cut one off with that explanation, in my opinion. All right, go ahead with your argument.
Okay. Well, the bottom line is, I was just saying, this, the phrase required foundation repairs is not defined anywhere else in the contract, but either by an amount of money, a minimum amount of money, or a certain result that's going to be obtained, and that leads to, I mean, that, there's no way you can interpret the contract otherwise. The appellant's position is that the parties relegated both the existence and the extent of the foundation repairs to these three companies. The and you're as you pointed out, if you read the contract that way, it's like the defendant is admitting that there are foundation repairs that need to be made. But there's three other places in the contract or in the mediation agreement where he specifically says he's not making any admissions or acknowledgments of any wrongdoing of damages. And this is in some of the recitals. He specifically says he denies and still denies any liability, denied and still denies any acts or omissions which were approximate cause of any damages to plaintiff, and has disputed and still disputes all parts of plaintiff's claims and extensiveness thereof. And then further down, he says that nothing in the settlement agreement should constitute an admission by either party regarding any of the merits of any claim or any defense in the litigation. So there's three different places in the contract, in the mediation agreement, where it specifically says we don't, I'm not admitting anything by entering into this agreement. I'm not agreeing that I did anything wrong. I'm not agreeing that there's any damages. I'm just entering into this as a matter of compromise. And I think it's inconsistent to read those and then to say, well, yeah, you admitted that there were foundation damages in light of those clauses. The bottom line is that, you know, he believes as a matter of law that he's complied with the contract. But going on to point of error number 3, which is equally important, in the event that he did breach the contract, in the agreement, in the event you say, yeah, there had to be some work done, the two other bids were for $3,000 and $8,300. There's nothing in the summary judgment evidence which supports a finding by the judge that it should be the $8,300. Either one, this is a jury issue that should go to the jury as to which one of these he should have picked, or as a matter of law, it should have been the $3,000. And I'd argue as a matter of law, it should be the $3,000 because you cannot obligate someone in a breach of contract lawsuit to do anything more than what they had to do to comply with the contract. And all he had to do to comply with the contract was, if he breached it, was to pay the $3,000. So it's the appellant's position that if you believe that the contract was breached, that as a matter of law, the damages should have been the $3,000, and if not, it's a jury issue. There's no summary judgment evidence. The appellee argues in his brief it was discretionary with the court to decide the damages. It's not discretionary on a summary judgment on a breach of contract. It's a matter of law issue. As to the fraud, just real quickly, there's just no evidence of any fraud whatsoever. It's a dispute over a contract. If he's wrong, he's wrong, and he breached the contract. There's no evidence he intended to go out and enter into this contract and not pay anybody. They have some inferences that because he changed attorneys and because he had a different attorney mail the check to the plaintiff for the repairs to the plaster and the paint, that this is some sort of intent to circumvent the system. And the cases say that when you have inferences of intent, that's a jury issue. They've granted summary judgment for fraud, and they don't have evidence of fraud. He's controverted the fraud in his affidavit. He said, I intended to comply fully with the agreement. I thought I was complying fully with the agreement. There's no evidence that he didn't, but if they did have evidence that he wasn't intending on complying with the agreement, that's controverted, and it's not a summary judgment issue. So there should be no damages for fraud. There should be no finding for fraud, and the fraud should go back. Further, the exemplary damages were not requested in the motion for summary judgment. So he's not entitled to exemplary damages on summary judgment. That's argument number four. Even if there was fraud, he didn't request punitive damages in summary judgment. He's requested in his pleadings, but as everyone knows, when you go into summary judgment, you can ask for a lot less than what's in your pleadings. And he doesn't mention the punitive damages, he doesn't plead for punitive damages, and he wasn't entitled to punitive damages on summary judgment. And the error number five, that it was error to award the punitive damages because there was no fraud. It kind of goes back to two. Two and five are kind of linked together. Two is basically saying there is no fraud, and five is saying you can't have the exemplary damages unless there is fraud. It can't stem from the breach of contract lawsuit.
We can't have exemplary damages if there are no actual damages.
I'm sorry?
You can't have exemplary damages if there are no actual damages either.
Right.
So in order to uphold the exemplary damages, we would have to read the judgment in such a way that the finding of actual damages is for fraud rather than contract.
Exactly. And it doesn't specify which it is. So I've brought an argument that there's not evidence to support either breach of contract or fraud. But even if you find that there's fraud, he didn't plead for exemplary damages. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Milk, are you ready?
Yes, Your Honor. And it's just Milks with an S.
Milks, I'm sorry.
I know it's very strange for the last name.
Milks.
May it please the court?
Counsel.
Your Honor, I'm pleased to be here on behalf of my client, Judith Rodriguez, this morning. We would like to thank you for your time and the resources that you've expended on this appeal. At the outset, Your Honors, I'd like to point out that of the two lawyers that are before you here today, only one of us was present at that eight-hour mediation that took place in the offices of the Honorable Judge Ted Aiken. Only one of us has insight as to exactly what the negotiations were like and why this settlement agreement reads exactly as it does. I would also like to point out that this is not a situation where an attorney came in and inflamed the passions of a judge within a 30-minute hearing, and that judge subsequently signed off on the first judgment that crossed his desk. Indeed, there was a week that passed between the date of that hearing until Judge Walker signed off on the judgment. Now, during that week, plaintiff submitted two proposed judgments, one for specific performance, which would actually require the appellant to go obtain those three bids, because our position as we stand here today, Your Honor, is there's only one bid that was obtained in this, which is that $8,330 bid. And we also submitted a proposed judgment based on damages.
What happened to the $3,000 bid?
Your Honor, the $3,000 bid is no bid at all either, and here's why. There is nothing on paper from Advanced Foundation Repair. The only thing we have is appellant's representation that they told him the work was going to be $3,000. From our experience, appellant's word is not good enough. And then we obviously have the zero bid, which our contention there is that is no bid at all either. So there was actually only one viable bid before the court obtained by appellant's own hand, which is the structured foundation repair bid for $8,330. The crux of appellant's argument is that the settlement agreement allowed him to select a zero bid in fulfillment of his obligations. Our contention is that the zero bid is indeed no bid at all. Now, obviously, these conflicting interpretations would seem to create some sort of ambiguity in the contract. But by looking at the clear meaning of the words contained in the settlement agreement, by examining the additional clauses that are present therein, and by considering the circumstances surrounding the formulation of this agreement, it becomes crystal clear that there is no such ambiguity. Words in a contract carry their generally accepted meaning. Just a brief recitation of the main clause that's at issue. Defendant Philip Thompson shall secure at least three foundation bids from reputable licensed contractors for the foundation repairs at 3121 Dorchester. From Webster's Ninth Collegiate Dictionary, defendant shall, will have to, must, complete, to bring to an end, and especially into a perfected state, to make whole or perfect, require, to claim or ask for by right or authority. Respectfully, Your Honor, the ordinary meaning of these words compelled a performance by the appellant.
How about the fact that it doesn't mention that the bids have to be in writing? Or I don't see it.
Your Honor, you're exactly right. There is not a requirement that the bids should be in writing.
So why does that preclude the $3,000 bid from being a legitimate bid, other than you subjectively didn't believe it?
Well, if we were to take appellant at his word, then I mean, you're right, Your Honor. That's all I have. And looking at the entirety of how this has gone down, I think you'd understand why I feel that way. But granted, that doesn't help you in looking at a strict interpretation.
What is your evidence of fraud?
Well, and I realize that it's somewhat problematic, but there was ample circumstantial evidence before Judge Walker in helping him reach that fraud determination. Going back to...
Can you have a summary judgment that is no fact question, no ambiguity, based on circumstantial evidence?
It's a tough call, Your Honor. And I think that's the major problem we have with this judgment. All I can surmise that the evidence in front of Judge Walker was such that he had no problem concluding in his mind that fraud had occurred here as a matter of law.
Okay, well, you were going to tell me the circumstantial evidence.
Sure,
of fraud.
Your Honor, sure. Going back to the very start of this, this all springs from a complaint that appellant had filed with the Better Business Bureau regarding repairs that had been done. That kicked off the entire lawsuit underneath. We had those issues been disclosed, none of this would have ever happened. The first bid he secured was that zero bid. That's at least some evidence that, well, that coupled with his non-performance, Your Honor, because it's clear in Aquaflex, which cited in Appellee's brief, that simply circumstantial evidence doesn't get you there. But if you've got non-performance coupled with circumstantial evidence, then potentially you can make a finding of fraud.
Non-performance meaning I didn't fix the repairs, I breached the contract?
Failure, well, exactly. And that's the difficulty, Your Honor. When are you going to have a defendant that comes back and says, hey, I breached the contract? I mean, it doesn't happen. So it's almost always going to be proven by subsequent acts after that breach occurs. The appellant submitted that zero bid, not to my office, but direct to yet another, or direct to my client through another attorney.
Were you representing your client at the time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. Throughout the
pen. That's a commission for lawyer discipline issue. Lawyers contacting clients directly when they're represented by counsel.
Agreed.
But not, I don't think that is an issue here.
Well, but once you start pulling everything together, Your Honor, and that's what it is. The court is no doubt familiar with the old saying, where there's smoke, there's fire. We had so much smoke here that the forest was burning down, and it has been for quite some time.
What about the fact that the zero bid and then the second and third bids were obtained during the summer, but there was not a bid turned over to your client until November?
It's 2 days before or a week before the deadline. Yes, Your Honor.
Was there a deadline?
Time was of the essence in the contract.
Okay.
We specifically stated that the repairs had to be done by December 1st, 2008. And as soon as that zero bid was submitted direct to my client, we immediately fired off a letter at the attorney that sent that, as well as got back with previous counsel for the appellant. Like I said, Your Honors, I will stand up here and freely admit there are some issues with the fraud claim. I don't pretend to know Judge Walker's mind in it. I can only suspect that the evidence that he had in front of him was such that he felt comfortable in finding fraud as a matter of law. That being said, if that issue is remanded and a breach of contract is upheld, that fraud claim never gets tried. It will be nonsense. We will not try that fraud claim. At this point, we're in the same position we were 4 years ago when we filed suit. We've got a house that's obviously got its own issues that have only gotten worse over time. We've got no resolution to this. At this point, we're looking for the absolute quickest way out to bring appellant to heel for the fidelity that he is demonstrating to his.
Why didn't you just go with specific performance?
Your Honor, I submitted the order to Judge Walker. That was one of the orders that was on the table.
Okay. Have y'all visited since then?
Yes, Your Honor.
During that week before Judge Walker ruled, he encouraged appellant to come back with a settlement offer. The amount that appellant came back with didn't even cover the cost of the second lawsuit.
Okay.
As far as some of the other issues that appellant's counsel has presented.
So what are you asking for here today? You want the cost of the foundation repair, and you want your attorney's fees. Are you entitled to your attorney's fees? Yes, breach of contract, right?
Right.
And obviously your appellate expenses. Is that what you're asking for? I'm going to ask him what he's asking for in a minute.
Well, Your Honor, more than anything, what I want, obviously we want some of our costs that we've incurred through the pendency of this thing. But more than anything, what I want is something, a mechanism to be able to bring appellant to heel to where he will do exactly what he said he was going to in the first place. Because all the money in the world, as you know, a judgment's worth a piece of paper it's printed on it. Now, there's certain things that appellant exposes himself to, contempt and such, but it's not like we're going to get a check cut to us as soon as we get a judgment. And I believe collecting on that judgment is going to be a tall order given my experience.
Well, I'm not sure this court can order specific performance if it's not asked for example. So I'm not sure what you're
asking for here.
Well,
usually we have a money judgment would be what you were asking for.
And, well, that's the order that was appealed from,
okay,
Your Honor. And
so you basically want affirmance of the summary judgment.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You want affirmance of the summary judgment for damages. Correct.
For the contract damages, and in the $8,330, which we believe is the only, it is a measure of damages as a matter of law because it was obtained by a reputable foundation company pursuant to the terms of the settlement agreement, obtained by appellant's own hand. So if it's, and I agree with you, Justice McCoy, I'm not certain that it is within your ability to order specific performance. But at the minimum, we would ask for the affirmation of that, of the 8330, and the attorney's fees go along with it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Is there any rebuttal? Mr. McCallum?
May it please the Court, the counsel for the appellee starts off talking about his insight into the issue and how much, you know, he knows because he was there at the mediation. And I think we're losing sight of an important concept, and that is that we're here on a motion for summary judgment. And specifically, as to the $3,000 bid, which he now wants to throw out, it was never raised on summary judgment that there was anything wrong with the $3,000 bid. I don't even believe it's raised in the appellee's brief that there's anything wrong with the $3,000 bid. And this is a summary judgment hearing. If he's going to contend that he's entitled to the or it's appeal of the summary judgment hearing, of the 8330, then he had to prove before the trial court by the summary judgment evidence that the 8330 was the proper measure of damages. And there's no evidence. I don't believe there's any summary judgment evidence that he even had any foundation damages. All he appealed was that there was a breach of the contract to repair the damages.
That last statement again, you don't think there was any summary judgment evidence that he had any foundation damages?
Yes, Your Honor.
But that's taken care of in the agreement.
Well, I agree. That's what I'm saying.
Repairs needed. That's
right.
Off the table.
At this point, all we're talking about is what's the proper measure of damages. So I'm saying right. I don't believe that's even relevant. And we had the $3,000 and the $8,300. It was not raised in the summary judgment evidence. And so what does he tell you? He's saying it's a credibility of the issue, of the witness issue. He's saying, I don't believe the guy that he got the $3,000 bid, so we shouldn't do it. Well, what exactly is a credibility of the witness issue? It's an issue for a trier of fact. It's not a summary judgment issue. The judge cannot decide at summary judgment, even if it had been before him, which witnesses he believes. It's whether it's uncontroverted. The witness in his affidavit said, I got a $3,000 bid. It was never objected to. It was never said that it wasn't competent under the agreement, that it was a qualified company. He's just saying now, well, I don't believe him. That goes to the weight of the testimony, and that's a jury issue, not a summary judgment issue. And the reason it wasn't a jury issue at the original hearing, because it wasn't even raised. It's being raised for the first time.
So tell me what you're wanting.
Well, preferably we'd like a finding that as a matter of law, he did not breach the contract. That the clauses in the contract where he says, I'm not admitting any liability, I'm not admitting any damages, in effect, I'm not admitting that there's any foundation damages, read in together with the bidding clause, make it that the foundation companies were the companies to decide whether anything was wrong with the foundation.
Well, just for argument purposes, let's suppose that dog won't hunt.
Okay, then I'd say that the damages should be $6,000. $3,000 for the second bid, $3,000 for the attorney's fees for bringing the breach contract suit.
All right, so you're not asking us to throw the summary judgment out and give the opportunity to try the fraud and breach case before a jury. You're asking us to determine as a matter of law that the damages should be $3,000 plus attorney's fees?
That would be our, if the court's going to not conclude as a matter of law, if the court's going to conclude that the contract was breached, yeah, we'd rather just get it over with and find the damages to be $3,000 and not go back and spend a lot of money on a jury trial.
So if we find the damages are $3,000, seems to me that you have to present some sort of writing that she can take the $3,000 and go to these people and have the repairs done with. I mean, how is she going to take the $3,000 and go get the foundation repaired if she doesn't even know where it came from or have a bid in writing? How would she enforce that?
Well, I don't know, Your Honor, but that's whether they would even do it for $3,000 at this point. I mean, that's 2 years ago, but that's what she would have got under the agreement. That's what she's suing for. The burden of proof was on him. As far as the fraud, you know, what the evidence shows is that the defendant had discharged his attorney from the mediation. He went and found another attorney and said, I've got this check. I'm supposed to send it to this lady. Will you mail it off for me? And he said, fine. And he put together a cover letter, and he mailed it off. He wasn't involved in the litigation. He didn't know what any of the issues were. He's basically just mailing off a letter for a friend. There's no evidence that the appellant was trying to deceive anybody by sending the check directly to her. The order said he's supposed to pay her. The mediation agreement says he's supposed to pay her. It didn't say send the money to his lawyer. Now, if he'd gone back to his lawyer would have known the protocol. He didn't go back to his original lawyer. He just went in and said, mail this off. And then he switched to another attorney, myself, when he became a big mess because that other attorney said, you know, you didn't hire me to represent you on this. You just asked me to send off a letter. So there's no evidence of any fraud whatsoever. And the cases say when it's an inference of fraud, when it's implied fraud, things like that, then that's a jury issue. It's not for a judge to decide fraud. You know, if a defendant came in and admitted and said, I defrauded this guy, then that'd be a different issue. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Thanks to both of you for your arguments. Your case is submitted, and you'll be excused.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Are the lawyers...